Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, August 8th, 2024, we're delighted to host a litigation update on challenges to the SAFE Plan, the Biden administration's most recent student loan forgiveness program. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today incredibly brief, but if you'd like to know more, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Abby Campley, who currently serves as Deputy Attorney General, focusing on special litigation and constitutional issues in the Office of the Kansas Attorney General. Before serving the state of Kansas, Mr. Campley was an assistant U.S. attorney prosecuting federal crimes in the Southern District of Indiana, and he was also formerly a defense counsel with the U.S. Air Force. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Shang Li, who currently serves as litigation counsel for the New Civil Liberties Alliance. Prior to joining NCLA, Mr. Li served as counselor to the Administrative Wage and Hour at the U.S. Department of Labor. He also formerly worked in the private sector as litigation associate at Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, and at Kirkland & Ellis. And I will leave it there. One last note, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature so we can get to those in our later portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Li, the floor is yours.
Hi, thank you so much for the kind introduction. Today we're talking about ongoing litigation against the Biden administration's SAVE plan, that's Saving on a Valuable Education plan. And for our listeners, it might be hard to keep track of all the different, so this is a student loan forgiveness plan. It might be hard to keep track of all the different student loan forgiveness plans out there. So just a little table setting and background. About a year ago, at the end of June 2023, the Supreme Court struck down in Biden v. Nebraska the $400 billion kind of mass forgiveness plan under the HEROES Act. And shortly thereafter, the Department of Education promulgated this current SAVE plan, which is a type of what's called the income-driven repayment plan where participating borrowers' monthly payments are determined based on their incomes. If your income is lower, your monthly payments are lower. And at the end of the repayment period, you can get your loans forgiven. And so that came out in July 2023. And this spring, we had two lawsuits filed, one in the District of Kansas, where Abby's leading that one, and a second one in the Eastern District of Missouri. Both suits were filed by states, so there were just two different groups of states, and I know Kansas in one of them and Missouri's in another one of them, but the other states, I get mixed up which one's in which. So Abby, you can enlighten us on that one. So Abby, I'll turn it to you. What is exactly, going on with the SAVE plan? What is it? What does it do? And why is Kansas and other states, why are they challenging it?
Yeah, so thank you to the Federal Society for inviting me to speak on this really important topic. So when we talk about where the SAVE plan, or what it is and what it does, we have to kind of view it on the whole big picture of what the administration was planning to do with student loan forgiveness. So it was part of a three-phase plan. The first was the HEROES Act forgiveness in Biden v. Nebraska, where they would forgive either 10 or 20,000 in loans unilaterally. So what this was is phase two. There's going to be phase three coming out later this fall. Phase two involves multiple aspects. They're using their authority under the Income Contingent Repayment Plan, which gives the secretary the authority to set up an income-driven repayment plan based on a borrower's income. So what this does is it takes kind of a, there's three major provisions. There's other parts that, are a little bit less relevant to the legal challenge, but for this part, there's three plans that are subject to the challenge. So one is the early loan forgiveness provision. This is the one that's kind of gotten the most headlines. It's one where if a borrower borrows below $12,000 in their original principal loan, then they can be subject to forgiveness after 10 years rather than the upper limit that the department has interpreted to be 20 or 25 years, depending on the type of loan. Another is, which I think is the most expensive part of the program, where they cap discretionary income through a different method than they were before. Previously, the caps on your discretionary income, which is the maximum you're required to pay if you're in one of these income contingent repayment plans, used to be 10% of your discretionary income up to 150% of the poverty line. They changed that so that for undergraduate loans, it's 5% of your discretionary income, and the max would be at 225% of the federal poverty line. And for context, a family of four that's making $70,000 a year, approximately, that would be subject to $0 payments. And it's created a situation where out of the 8 million people that are under the SAFE plan, 57% have $0 payments. So
how does that compare with the previous versions of the income driven repayment plans that the department had been operating?
Yeah, so it has kind of a long and complicated history where one of the things that they relied on is that they had the pay in the repay program, which they said allowed the secretary to exercise his discretion and come up with income contingent repayment plans that are not explicitly in line with what they claim that Congress has provided. And the main aspect of that, the two problems in that argument is one, nobody challenged those prior payment plans. So just because no one's challenged it doesn't make them legal. But the other bigger aspect is that the cost of those programs and what they were trying to do can't even compare to what's happening in the SAFE plan. And that's one of the things the district court judge found. So for context, the repay plan, which was the last one that they came out with prior to the SAFE plan, the cost of that was $15 billion. This one, using the correct estimates, it's $475 billion. So there's a huge difference when the program costs 30 times as much. And then second, although they expanded those programs beyond the target audience for what Congress had in mind, they still stuck to the thresholds that Congress provided. So the pay and repay plans, they never went beyond the 10% income threshold, and they never went beyond 150% of the federal poverty line. This is the first time that the department has created its own numbers out of thin air.
Yeah, so you talk about the numbers that Congress provided. So my understanding is that Congress passed a law, I think the first time it was 2007, where they said it was 15% of income above 150% of your poverty line. And then in 2010, they made it a little more generous, and they said your maximum payment is 10% above that 150% of the poverty line threshold. So that seems like a pretty hard and fast congressionally enacted threshold. And I understand the department's not using that statutory authority. They're using a different statutory authority to develop their own threshold. What is the department's, what do they say in their rulemaking for that?
Yeah, they're saying that, the provision, so they're relying on 20 USC 1087E, which is the plan for income contingent repayment. They're saying that that other provision, which sets out the target numbers, is from 20 USC 1098E, which is what they're not relying on for authority. But given that there's multiple aspects of it, but the district court found that this is, when you're talking about the major questions doctrine, which we can expand on a little bit more, if it's a transformational wielding of power, or if it has cost estimates beyond what they do, it just heightens the threshold for what level of authorization they're required to find. And the one thing that they're trying to do with the authority for income contingent repayment programs, they're effectively relying on a vague statutory grant, which, allows the secretary some.
When was that? When was that grant first made?
I believe it was, I want to say it was the late 1990s that they first had the statutory, income contingent repayment program. But the main thing is that it can't, it gets to the point where it's no longer a repayment program if, you know, you're getting to the point where the majority of people are making $0 payments, because that cuts against the idea of having a repayment too. And then another problem with that argument is the statutory provision says nothing about loan forgiveness, and it definitely says nothing about a period of time where you can do 10 years instead of the 20 years or 25 years that are subject to that. And from a big picture perspective, if you accept that broad grant of authority that they can make up any numbers that they want, what is the limiting principle? So is there anything, for instance, preventing the Secretary of Education from deciding, okay, we're going to set your maximum repayment at 0.5% of your discretionary income, which we'll define as 500% of the poverty line. So when you have no limiting principle, that creates another issue. Oh. So there's multiple lines of attacks that we had in our case.
So in the one that Congress enacted, 1098, Section 1098, with the 10% and the very specific limits, does that have language saying certain amount will be forgiven after the repayment term?
No, it does not. It just says, you know, the repayment plan is to last about 25 years. So it's at best an open question as to whether what happens with the loans after that period is over. We're operating off the assumption, you know, in our case, that maybe there's some, you know, argument to be made that after 25 years, the loan is to be forgiven. But other aspects of the rule indicate that, or when you read the statute as a whole, it can't be 10 years because Congress expressly authorized, you know, for instance, the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Plan, where the cap is 10 years for forgiveness. And the statute requires that it be extended for an extended period of time. The standard repayment time is 10 years. So it has to be at least more than 10 years, which, you know, cuts against what they're relying on. Well,
so I know CBO, it might be getting too much into the weeds with the cost stuff, but I know CBO always does these, you know, costing estimates for new legislation. Was there one for this, you know, original law that the department is relying on that might suggest, you know, they said it costs billions and billions of dollars. The CBO said that might suggest it does forgive loans. But is there something like that in the record?
So stepping back to, you know, when you look at the big picture legislative history of this, the idea was this whole thing would be cost neutral. Because while there was some discussion as to, you know, maybe a small portion of people would not be in a position to have their loans fully paid back after the 25-year period, the idea would be the vast majority of people are still paying more than what they took out. So the idea was that overall it would be a net revenue generator for the government, not a net a decline for the treasury. So that's another aspect that, you know, that's an issue here. But I think stepping back to the big picture of what, you know, what's going on here, their estimates were that, you know, this program would cost $156 billion for reasons that we, you know, can get into a little bit later.
So this is the save plan would be $150 billion. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. So for reasons that we'll discuss later, the actual cost was $475 billion. So the idea that Congress would implicitly hide this authority for the Secretary of Education to spend $475 billion in a provision that requires repayment just stretches the law to basically absurd conclusions that can't possibly be what they intended.
And my understanding is the secretary isn't even claiming that he's exercising the zenith of his authority here, right? No. It doesn't have to be 5%. It could be 3%. Like you said, it could be 0.5%. And if he did do that, and I guess he claimed his asserted authority isn't incompatible with 0.5%. And if he did do that, it would be quite a bit more than $475 billion, as you say, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so that's one of the other aspects. When we step back to why we're doing the challenge, you know, we definitely have the state-specific harms. So when we talk about the early loan forgiveness provision. They did that retroactively. So now, because of the American Rescue Plan and states that tie their definition of income to the federal plan, states lose out on tax revenue. Another aspect that we raised was, you know, state instrumentalities are harmed and things of that sort. And but from a big picture, you know, kind of rule of law perspective, if you eliminate, if you give the Secretary of Education the authority to do this, then there is really no meaningful limit on agency power as a general matter. And then when we see that the Secretary of Education, you know, recently sent out an email to a number of borrowers saying that they're going to him, the Secretary of Education and President Biden are going to fight Republican elected officials every step of the way because they're trying to harm forgiveness. So you're wielding the Treasury for political benefit, and it's an agency that's doing it rather than any branch of government in particular. If there's no limits to prevent that, then there's really no limits on agency power as a general matter.
Right. So I think, do you think the case or your argument really boils down to this interpretive major questions principle? Because I just pulled up the 1087 statute here, and the authorization does seem very broad and very vague. If you look at the text, and it says it's just an income contingent repayment plan that has to be based on the aggregate income of the borrower. 5% or 2% or whatever percent of your income, that's certainly based on your aggregate income, isn't it?
So this question was very closely related to the same issue in Biden v. Nebraska, where they're trying to use, in that case, they were trying to use terms like waive and modify and put it in the context that equates the ability to forgive loans. So what the major questions doctrine requires is, if it's something of vast political or economic significance, then they're required to show more than a colorable or a plausible textual basis for the authority that they're wielding. And in this case, it's definitely economically significant, even if you use their estimates. The program cost $156 billion. In other cases, the Supreme Court has said even $50 billion is enough to trigger the threshold. And when you talk about the political significance, just the way that they're treating the case is alone a big window into how politically significant the case is. And it's obviously a hot button political topic, which there's a vast amount of debate around. And Congress has tried many times to pass student loan relief in terms of debt forgiveness and hasn't been able to. So it's clearly met, even though they tried to contest that in their litigation now at the 10th Circuit. So the only question is, do they have clear authorization under the statute? And this is where the District of Kansas, that's the argument that they ended up relying on in their opinion. And there's nothing here that says that gives them clear authorization to effectively have the majority of borrowers have $0 payments. And there's nothing that allows them to forgive loans after 10 years if your balance is below a certain amount. They have to show clear authorization, and nothing in the statute comes close to doing that.
Okay. So before we get ahead of ourselves on the kind of merits of this, which I think we just talked about a lot, I mean, obviously in the Nebraska v. In the Biden v. Nebraska case, one serious issue was whether the states had standing to challenge the loan forgiveness program at all. And my understanding that was a major question here too. So, can you talk about what sort of were the states' theories of standing that gets them into court in the first place, and how that went in? Before the Kansas court and I guess the Missouri court as well, if you can.
Yeah. So stepping back, kind of what the court found in Biden v. Nebraska, there were multiple standing theories that were raised in that case. The Supreme Court only got to one of them, which was the fact that MOHELA was a state instrumentality in the state of Missouri. And because they serviced these federal loans as a contractor for the Department of Education, and they would lose some of the fees that were associated with that, that they definitely had harm. And this, the Supreme Court concluded that they didn't need to look at the other standing theories. And if one state had standing, then everyone had standing and the claim can proceed. So for the Missouri case, it was pretty straightforward. Missouri still had MOHELA. They were still harmed by this. So it was pretty straightforward how the Missouri court found that they had standing. With Kansas, we had 11 states total in our coalition. 9 of them have a state income tax, and they all mirrored their definition of federal income to the federal definition. So one of the standing, one of the harms that we raised in the case was the fact that under the American Rescue Plan, until 2026, loan forgiveness is non-taxable as income. And by accelerating loan forgiveness unlawfully to an earlier time frame, states lose the ability to tax it. And as a result, lost hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in revenue as a result of that. Another is...
I just want to stay with that one for a moment there. I guess, like, is there... The department responded to that, right? With the idea that it's... Because the states, their income tax code is created by the state legislature.
Yep.
So did the department raise like a sort of self-inflicted sort of argument there?
Yeah, so they raised a case called Pennsylvania v. New Jersey, which talks about some aspects of, you know, if a state is responsible for its own harm, that might not create standing. But there's other case law that that cuts against that. So one of the things that we pointed out is in either scenario, whether, you know, they continue with the same laws that they have and suffer this harm, or whether they go to the state legislature and change their laws and then as a result lose the benefit of pairing their income tax systems with the federal government, that it's a harm in either direction. And Texas v. United States in the Fifth Circuit, which was the DAPA case that talked about the loss from driver's licenses, the federal government at that point raised the same argument, but the Fifth Circuit held, and it was affirmed by an equally divided court in the Supreme Court in that case, was that, well, if an unlawful federal regulation is pressuring states to change their laws, that's also confers standing. So that's what we raised in this one. It did not, the district court did not agree with that, and we're raising that as a secondary theory of standing in the state, in the 10th Circuit. But there were other theories of standing that we also raised, one of which the district court obviously agreed with, or else they wouldn't have given us relief. So I can talk about the public service loan forgiveness one or the state instrumentality one, whichever one you prefer.
Why don't you start with the state, the one that you guys won on in the district court, just so that's we know that's how you're in the court in the first place.
Yep. So the one, three states in our coalition, Alaska, South Carolina, and Texas, they have state instrumentalities that service student loans as well. So the difference is that they're not a direct contractor with the Department of Education, but they have what's called FFEL loans. And without getting too much into the weeds of what that, you know, what that entails, but basically these are a form of government loans that were stopped in 2009 and are not eligible for the benefit, and a borrower who has one of these is not eligible for the loan forgiveness provisions under the SAFE plan. So what's happening and what's happened before under the HEROES Act as well is that when people see these benefits, they're consolidating their loans with the federal government, and these loan servicers, they lose out on interest income because all they get back is the principal and whatever interest was accrued at the time the consolidation occurred. So they would lose all future interest income as a result of that. And we got multiple declarations from each of these servicers that spells out exactly what that harm looks like. And the district court did agree that that is a form of standing because no one contested that these are state instrumentalities. So it just boiled down to a fact-specific inquiry as to whether they were facing harms or not. And it's pretty clear that if people are given incentives to consolidate and the federal government is actively encouraging people to do this, then they're going to lose interest income. And that's a straightforward pocketbook harm.
Ah, so the government was telling people with field loans, if I understand correctly, here's how you turn them into forgivable loans under the SAVE plan. And in doing so, there's less field loans for the Alaska and South Carolina and Texas. Is that yep. right?
Yep. And then these instrumentalities lose out on income, and these were all statutorily created instrumentalities that that are definitely arms of each state. So they operate the same way as Mobile. It's just the way that they experience losses is a little bit different.
Got it. Understood. And then and I think your final theory of standing,
this one, it was raised in another case involving the Mackinac Center.
Okay, full disclosure, that was one of my cases, and I apologize for it being a bad precedent in your case.
That's fine. But so basically, one of the last standing theory that we raised that the district court agreed with, but we're raising at the 10th Circuit as well. So it remains to be seen what courts ultimately do with this. But basically, this was not raised in the HEROES Act forgiveness, to my knowledge, but this was the public service loan forgiveness harm. And basically what it states is that for people with intra-original loan balances of less than $12,000, what happens is that they still get the same forgiveness at the same time as if they were in the public sector. So we raise this under the competitor standing doctrine, which states that if the government unlawfully creates conditions that makes it harder to compete in the marketplace, that alone can confer standing regardless of whether you can show an injury in terms of, for instance, if someone's 8 years into their loan forgiveness timeline in the public sector, that gives them a serious incentive to stay for two more years rather than switch to the private sector. But if they can switch to the private sector and get the same forgiveness anyway, that makes public service less of an option when they're considering what to do. So that is a competitive injury. And the district court disagreed with that. And, we are raising that with the 10th Circuit as well. So that's another standing theory that was raised in our case. And all of these theories were also raised in the Missouri case, but kind of the big picture of what happened, the judge in Missouri found that they were standing based on Mohila. He didn't get to the other states in the standing theories they raised, since he found that one state had standing. So all of them were allowed to stay in the case. The District of Kansas took a different approach. They concluded that at least Alaska, South Carolina, and Texas had standing. But what the judge found was that it was within his discretion to still examine the standing of the remaining states, and he found that the eight other states did not have standing, which included Kansas. So all of them were eliminated from the case. So it's right now a three-state coalition that won the district court injunction.
And are the eight states who were dismissed, are they also on appeal on the standing issue in the 10th Circuit?
Yes, they filed a notice of appeal as well. So, and then the three remaining states in there. So in that case, the Department of Education is the appellate. So they're appellees, the three states. So in their response, they're also raising the same secondary theories of standing that the eight dismissed states also did.
Okay. So the 10th Circuit is poised to rule on on the in-state instrumentality theory, but also the public service and the state tax code theories are also before the court. Great. Great. So that's sort of now we know how the states in yours and Missouri's case are in the courts. And how did the how did the courts come out on the merits? My understanding is this the same is no longer happening right now. How did that come to be?
Yeah, so it took a long and winding road to get to this point. But big picture right now, the SAVE plan can't be implemented anywhere in the country. So I'll kind of walk through the path of how we ultimately got there. So first what happened is both injunctions came out on the same day. So
was that planned or was that just serendipity?
We don't know how that came to be. We just saw, We saw our injunction and then saw the Missouri injunction came out the same day. So in our injunction, the judge concluded that, yeah, the plan was unlawful because it was a major question and they did not show clear authorization for it. And the judge concluded that we met all the other factors for injunctive relief to include irreparable harm. But what he did was he concluded that we showed irreparable harm for the parts that were about to take effect, but not to the ones that already did. And we disagree with that interpretation, and we're doing a cross appeal in the Tenth Circuit to basically close that loop. But basically, everything that took effect before July 1st, which relates to the lower payments provisions, but not to everything that took effect after July 1st. What the Missouri court did was it took a different approach and said the payment plan, the SAFE plan, was lawful except to the provisions that relate to loan forgiveness, because Congress spelled out the different conditions where loans can be forgiven, and this just isn't one of them. So the portions that go towards early forgiveness, they enjoined. But in the, so then what happened was each case took a different turn. So in the 10th Circuit case, the Department of Education moved for a stay, while in the 8th Circuit, Missouri and the other states moved for an injunction pending appeal. The 10th Circuit granted the stay in our case, and they came out with an unreasoned opinion that had a 2-1 with a dissent, and basically stated that they met the factors for a stay and didn't get anything beyond that in terms of reasoning. So it got stayed in the 10th Circuit. But then with Missouri's injunction pending appeal, the 8th Circuit granted, we'll just style it an administrative stay. It's really an administrative injunction, but they gave an administrative stay, and they have yet to come out with the full ruling on the injunction pending appeal. But basically the administrative stay prohibited them from enforcing the SAFE plan at all anywhere in the country. So we also, after the 10th Circuit granted a stay, we also went to the Supreme Court for a full vacator of the stay and asked cert before judgment as well, which was similar in terms of the process for how Biden v. Nebraska ended up at the Supreme Court. But basically, we did that before the 8th Circuit's injunction or administrative injunction was granted. So that one is still pending as well. So right now, it's being litigated at both the Supreme Court and the 10th Circuit at the same time, while at the same time we have the 8th Circuit's administrative injunction. So that's kind of one of the interesting aspects.
A lot of layers to this cake, yeah.
Yeah.
So the only, my understanding is the only court opinions that really analyze the merits of this rule are the two district court opinions, because the 8th Circuit and the 10th Circuit opinions are just unreasoned. One line or two, one sentence, sort of, it's a stay or it's an injunction, without really going into the details. I thought it was interesting that the Missouri District Court and the Kansas District Court found at the injunction stage that the rules were unlawful for different reasons. The different aspects were likely to be unlawful, that is. Right. So in Missouri, you said they said the forgiveness provisions were likely to be unlawful, but the reduction of monthly payments, that they thought was okay, right?
Yeah. And I'm not as, in the details of the Missouri case that I am in the Kansas case, but based on what I was able to examine of that opinion, it did seem like the Missouri judge believed that they had a textual basis for lowering repayments under their authority to create an income contingent repayment plan, but that authority didn't extend to forgiving loans. But
just staying with that for a second, it just seems to me, if you, let's say you can reduce your payments to zero or virtually zero, but you can never forgive them. But after a certain number of years, that seems to me like a functional forgiveness.
Yeah, and that's what Missouri is arguing on appeal as well. So any day now, we should be getting a typically, when a court gives an administrative stay, the intent is that they'll come out with a reasoned opinion later. So I would be surprised if the 8th Circuit didn't give a fully reasoned opinion on whichever way they go under the full injunction pending appeal. So we can, you know, maybe get a little more glimpse as to what the Eighth Circuit thinks about it at that point. But yeah, it does create a functional forgiveness, and it kind of also ignores the kind of, or doesn't address the major questions doctrine issue as far as what constitutes clear authorization. And that's where the Kansas court went into place. And the main issue with Kansas is they didn't believe that any aspect was lawful, or the judge didn't. They basically said they didn't show clear authorization, and they included the, you know, early provisions of loan forgiveness within that. It's just that the irreparable harm prong was not met according to the district court, and that wouldn't go towards the merits of it, though.
Understood. Okay, that's interesting.
And the 10th Circuit, their oral argument is set for August 21st, so there was expedited briefing that was set on that case, and they're doing a special sitting on August 21st to have the oral argument. So the 10th Circuit will probably weigh in very soon, too.
And is it the same panel that stayed the injunction below, or is it going to be a different panel in the 10th Circuit?
We don't know who the panel is yet, but it's not necessarily the same panel. So it's most likely we'll be getting a different set of judges.
Okay. And the district court in Kansas ruled for you on the merits of the major questions doctrine. Did the court also sort of analyze just the plain text, you know, independent of the doctrine, or was it just the doctrine and just applying the clear authorization language, seeing it's not there and ending it?
So the court concluded that the text actually gives them a colorable or plausible basis for the authority. Now, given, you know, it came out before Loper-Bright was decided, so it remains to be seen whether that's enough of a threshold when you're talking about the best reading of a statute. So that remains to be seen. But given that colorable, plausible textual base is not enough for the major questions doctrine anyway, it didn't matter for this case.
I can see looking at the text, it does say, you know, make a plan, make it based on income, and that's all it says. It also says make it an appropriate portion of the person's income,
right?
Whatever.
Yeah, and you know, some of the statutory arguments that will continue to be litigated depending on which way the 10th Circuit goes, and then obviously we're going to at some point litigate final judgment at the district court level, is also when you're talking about, does a repayment plan that anticipates, you know, use the word repayment multiple times in there, authorize a situation where most people are getting $0 payments, and then the average undergraduate borrower under that plan would only repay about $6,100 for every $10,000 borrowed. So it's effectively turning it into a $3,900 grant for every $10,000 someone borrows. Is that become a repayment plan at that point if you're paying back significantly less? So even if, you know, we accept the premise that there's some vague statutory authority to set some type of, to have some type of forgiveness at the end of 25 years, does that necessarily give you the ability to effectively turn loans into
credit? It's a lot like the Biden v. Nebraska case in that sense, in that, you know, the term waive or modified, if you read it as broadly as you want, it could mean just delete the account or forgive everything. Is that necessarily the best way to read those words? And in that case, the Supreme Court said, no, it's they prefer much more limited power. Could see it happening here as well. So you mentioned that you're also litigating to final judgment in the Kansas case. How is that proceeding? Is that paused during the appeal, or is that still moving forward?
So we have a joint motion before the court right now to provide an update after the Supreme Court decides on our emergency litigation. So it remains to be seen what the schedule for that will look like.
Okay. Well, great. That's all I have for now. If you have any kind of lasting words that we could, you know, predictions or not predictions, but just, you know, where the cases are going. But it sounds like things are sort of still up in the air in various different levels. Basically all three levels of the federal judiciary are there's things going on in this case.
Yeah. So in terms of the path forward, yeah, there's a lot of variables, and we'll have to see obviously what the 10th Circuit decides, and then what the 8th Circuit decides after that. But if the 8th Circuit goes, you know, consistent with what the administrative injunction gave and concludes that there should be an injunction pending appeal, it will be paused throughout the process of litigation unless the Supreme Court steps in. Or like, if you're kind of familiar with what happened in the last round of loan forgiveness, there was an injunction pending appeal granted by the 8th Circuit, and then the Department of Justice skipped getting an actual judgment at the 8th Circuit and went straight to the Supreme Court. I don't know if they're going to do that again this time or not, but yeah, I mean, barring the 8th Circuit changing its mind on the actual judgment or the Supreme Court stepping in, that administrative injunction will stay in effect for the pendency of the litigation. So that's kind of where we're at right now. We're obviously going to continue litigating in the 10th Circuit and the Supreme Court with our case, and we'll wait for them to weigh in. But yeah, I mean, it is definitely a tough road to see, you know, kind of what the path is for the SAFE plan to go into effect, given all the litigation that's happened so far, and the fact that you have two district courts that enjoined and the 8th Circuit granting a full administrative injunction. So we're, you know, when you're talking about whether an unlawful rule goes into effect, there's a lot that has to happen for it to do so at this point. And kind of stepping back, when you look at the big picture of why, you know, of what the whole problem is with an agency doing this, I mean, one of the things that the Biden administration kept rolling out with was, you know, this quote that the Supreme Court blocked him, but he did it anyway. It's how far can, you know, if an agency is told by the highest court they can't do something, but then insist on doing it anyway, and then at the same time are wielding the Treasury as a political tool when they don't even have authorization to spend the money in the first place, at that point, the agency becomes the most powerful branch of government. And that spells a lot of disastrous implications for the rule of law overall. So things like this have to be challenged. And then when states are harmed like they were here, they are the ones that have to step up and do this. So that is why we're doing this challenge.
Well, thank you. That's actually, I think, a good way to transition to some of our audience Q&As. John Capos asked, the first time the president tried this, the Supreme Court said no way. It seems somewhat defiant for the president to just do it again, despite the Supreme Court's smackdown. Can you comment on whether the legal basis for the second try is sufficiently distinct from the first try that the president can credibly say it's in good faith, as opposed to not just brazenly defying the Nebraska decision?
Yeah, so their argument is that they're using a different statutory authority this time, which is the Higher Education Act, instead of the HEROES Act, which is what they were using last time. The HEROES Act was a 9/11 provision, while this one is, you know, more tied to education writ large, since it is a lot of what gives the secretary the authority to do anything. So it's a different authority that they're using, but it doesn't change the fact that they have to show where the, like, that they actually have an authorization for it. They can't just say, okay, we're using a different statute this time, and, you know, if you read it vaguely enough, it gives us the authority. They still have to demonstrate, especially in a major questions doctrine case, where that clear authorization is. And there is no clear authorization in this text. And, you know, we didn't get to this earlier, but kind of some of the messiness that happened with the rule, like, you know, for instance, they did a cost estimate of $156 billion, but they were operating off the assumption that the forgiveness in Biden v. Nebraska would hold up. And that basically caused their baseline to be off by $435 billion when they weren't. And the final rule came out 10 days after that case was decided, but they never updated those cost estimates. So the real cost of the program is $475 billion. So when you're getting to the point where the agency is spending so much money that they're off by hundreds of billions, it leads to some pretty...
I do remember some commenters, I think, actually raised that issue. And the department, interestingly, responded to them saying, we are confident that we will win the Biden v. Nebraska case in a final rule that was published 2 weeks after they lost the Biden v. Nebraska case.
They had an explanation, you know, that was sent to the printer before that. But even still, it was enjoying nationwide at that point. So an oral argument happened. So they couldn't have been confident after that, that it would be upheld. So, yeah, I mean, that's another argument that we raised that the court didn't have to get to because they concluded for us on statutory grounds. But yeah, I mean, it is arbitrary and capricious to not include an accurate cost estimate in when you're talking about how much loans you're forgiving.
All right. Well, so the next audience question comes from Jason Coleman, and he asked, is there a floor above which the Department of Education must require payments, whether that's an income threshold or percentage of disposable income, or are you just arguing that what they've done is too low without stating what the minimum is? So I guess to distill that, do you think there is, is there a threshold that you think is the correct threshold?
In terms of the lower payments provision?